Greta Gerwig grew up with Louisa May Alcott's classic novel Little Women. It's a story that ennobles family relationships, everyday domestic life, and the dreams and ambitions of girls in a time when those ambitions weren't very welcome. In her Oscar-nominated screenplay, she ingeniously makes it a Greta Gerwig original while remaining extremely faithful to the source material.
I want to start with the end, actually. The final scene, and I'm sure this has been pointed out, but Joe watching the book being assembled through the glass immediately made me think of a new mother watching a baby through the glass, and that has to be intentional.
Yes. Well, actually, I had always sort of thought of it that way, but I hadn't actually explicitly said that to any of my collaborators that it was that, because Louisa May Alcott always said that Jo March should have been a literary spinster with books for children. That should have been her fate, but that she gave her this other ending because she felt pressure from the fans and her publisher to do so. But I'd never actually said, okay, I want it to be like a maternity ward. And then my production designer, Jess Gonscher, who's just amazing, and he's worked with so many great directors, like Bennett Miller and the Coen brothers, and he's terrific. And he showed me the mock-up of the, because he was going to build the publishing house on a stage. And he showed it to me, and I was like, Jess, it's a maternity wing. And he was like, oh my God, you're totally right. So it was something that I knew, but was unspoken, but that he unconsciously picked up on, because that's exactly what he built when he made it. And I think that, for so many reasons, I find that scene to be emotional, but that kind of sense of the thing that is in your soul then becoming externalized is a deep feeling of satisfaction, I think, I would imagine, for a writer, that you could hold the book you wrote.
Among other things, because this film is many things, but it is a love story between an artist and her art form. Her creativity is the love of her life, in a way, besides her family, obviously. And so for it to then produce this baby, I just thought that was a beautiful motif.
Yes, it's an art baby. It is a love story between a girl and her book. And it was something that with, as a writer and as a director, I was getting to play almost with this idea of a movie within a movie, that I got to shoot, you know, this romantic chase in the rain, and I have the cymbals crashing and the thunderclaps and all the stuff. It's something, you know, when I was working with Alexandre Desplat, who wrote the music, when we were working on that section, and I was like, let's do it up. I want like timpani and all this stuff. I want all the stuff. But also, we always talked about the writing as romantic, and the sequence where she writes the book over many days in the attic, that was, I said, write me the kind of music you'd write if, like, the two characters who belong together are coming together, and, you know, it's like love. That's what I want. I want it to feel like that, like passion. And so it's both intellectual and it's passionate.
The structure that you chose, mm-hmm. and specifically the parallels that you drew between the timelines, mm-hmm. how did you come up with the idea of splitting it up and jumping back and forth between timelines?
That was a really early idea for me, this starting it when they were adults and really grounding it in adulthood, and then having childhood be something they're in conversation with. I mean, I think there's a few reasons why I did that. The biggest one was I wanted to ground it in the sense of authorship. And so to start the movie when Jo is grown up and trying to sell another story, but trying to sell a story, it instantly places it there. And I think this idea of childhood or girlhood being is that what happened, or is that how you wrote it down? And I think that that's always an interesting disconnect to me. And the parts where they're similar and the parts where they diverge. The truth is, it is these two different timelines, and people sometimes say, oh, it goes back in time. But actually, the way it's structured is there's just two different origin points of the story, but everything moves forward. So one starts in 1868 and everything moves forward, and one starts in 1861 and everything moves forward. So you're never jumping back within a timeline, you're only moving forward.
But you found these ingenious parallels, like visual parallels or story parallels, that to me enrich the whole experience. There's the obvious thing with them Beth's two brushes with death and the visual parallel you find there. But on rewatch, I found when Marmee comes in on Christmas morning and she sort of collects herself and comes in with a different attitude. Yeah. Joe does the same thing right when she finds out that Laurie and Amy are married.
Yes. That's right. That's well spotted. You are the first person to spot that. Yeah, it's the things we do for the people we love that we make it okay for them. And I think something I wanted was to create these echoes all over the movie. And there's echoes like that. And then there's echoes that sometimes people catch, some people don't catch. But this is from the book. Some of the echoes are really from the book, which I found all over the place between childhood and adulthood, which I thought were sort of amazing how much they spoke to each other. But one of them was in childhood, Amy burns Joe's book. And in adulthood, Joe burns all of her own work, which I had completely forgotten until I read the book again. It's after Friedrich criticizes that kind of writing. She burns everything she wrote. And I was like, that's just such an extreme thing to do. It's like a potlatch. It's like a burning it to the ground. And in the novel, she burns it to the ground and then she doesn't start again. She stops up her inkstand. But, you know, I wanted it to be burnt to the ground so then she could build something new again. These echoes were something I was finding all over the book. So building them explicitly into the movie was something that felt like an extension of what was already there. It didn't feel like an invention by me. It felt like an extrapolation.
Did you ever feel like you were dealing with like a sacred text that you needed to be careful with? Or did you feel a freedom to kind of mix and match some of this stuff?
It did feel like a sort of sacred or important text, especially because of how much it has meant to so many different women, I think, and men. I did treat a lot of the language in the book as sacred, especially the famous language, like Christmas morning, like all the lines they say. Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents. It's so dreadful being poor. It's not fair that some girls have lots of pretty things and other girls have none at all. Like, those lines are just, for 150 years, you know, that's the opening of the book. So I didn't want to alter the language to quote-unquote modernize it. I wanted it to become modern through its own delivery. So that, you know, I've had this experience watching Shakespeare. I mean, sometimes you watch Shakespeare and you feel like, I have no idea what's happening or what anyone's saying. And then sometimes you'll see a production and you're like, oh my God, wait, I understand it. Why do I understand it? Like, it feels modern, even though they're using the language. Like, the intention is so clear. And I think that injecting all of that language with just that excitement and vitality of youth, you know, that feeling of like, you're the first people to ever say these words. That was part of it. And then, you know, what I was doing with the order and the feeling, I mean, it was a bit scary. It was a swing. I think the whole thing was a big swing, but I think because I started writing it almost 6 years ago, I started writing it, I didn't really have a sense that anyone would ever make it, which was a good thing because it allowed me to do things I might not have done otherwise.
In terms of the kind of fluidity of timelines, what did you need the music to do in order to help distinguish between the timelines or to kind of blend it all together?
I knew from the very beginning it was going to be a ton of music. And I knew I wanted someone like Alexandre, who is one of the great cinematic composers, I think, who's done it. I, in a funny way, always thought of this as a musical without songs. He said to me later, he said, oh, you've made a ballet. I think one of the first things he wrote was when they're all together on the beach, and it's this glorious score. It reminds me of my favorite composer that I could never work with because he's not with us, but Delarue, George Delarue. And it's lush and full and just, it's just wonderful. And also, this is also aching because it's so beautiful. And then it cuts to, you know, 8 years later, and Joe and Beth are on the beach again, and it's, they're older, and Beth is not well, and he does this thing where he just creates almost like the skeleton of the music you just heard. And that was the first thing, and I was like, that's exactly right, that's exactly what I meant, now do this everywhere. So it was about creating that kind of fullness of youth And then this echo of what that had been. I knew I didn't want him to do anything that was anachronistic. I didn't want any instruments that wouldn't have been around in the 19th century. It was finding what felt fresh by finding what was real. Like, I'm a big believer in movies, everything is everything. So the closer I hewed to the constraints, the more fresh it seemed. And people would be like, wow, that's, you must have just made that up. And I was like, no, it was there. That was what we, and so with the music, that was part of what we did. We said we didn't want it to be synth or anything like that.
Why was it important to you to draw out the Mr. Lawrence story?
I found that character in the book just deeply heartbreaking. And to me, it was the key to also giving Beth her due, because I think the way people think of her is, she's sick, and that her artistic ambitions are somehow less than her sister's because of her illness. So sometimes I think this idea of her playing like hymns in a corner without a lot of bravado. And Eliza Scanlon is actually a pianist. But this connection between her and Mr. Lawrence through music and allowing her to sit at that piano and play, not pokey hymns, but like Kinderszenen and Brahms, and you know, she loves great things, I felt like was a key to her soul. And it was a thing in the book, this journey of Beth over to the Lawrences, that, and he would make sure that it was quiet and that no one would disturb her. It's this beautiful part in the book. She never knew why new music appeared on the piano stand each day, and it was him.
Early in the film, when Laurie comes home with them for the first time after Meg sprained her ankle, and he's just sort of standing there watching the family, yes, and sort of basking in the warmth of this family. Yes. That was the scene where I started to kind of lose it and then kind of didn't gain it back the whole rest of the movie. But that is actually really how this movie makes me feel, is sort of like the warmth and vitality of this just overflowing love that people have for each other is so vivid in this movie. And I don't know how you did that. I know it's in the source material. I know it's a great cast, but you, yeah, somehow kindled this fire of love that is just, you just have to kind of get warmed by. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is there in the source material. It is there in the cast. To me, that moment when we were shooting it, when he was looking at the family, that was it. It made me ache for him, because his character is like, his mother died, his father died, he'd been raised in Europe, sort of in exile, he's back, he doesn't have anyone, he lives in a big house, and then it's like this community of women that he's allowed to step into their world, and that they're letting him be part of it in the mess and the joyfulness. And I love the way, you know, Joe just calls across like, can I call you Teddy? And like, they're all just talking at him. And when we were shooting it, I was like, I love this moment.
That ache you mentioned that he feels, I think Joe feels that too. Yeah. And I think something you captured, and it reminds me of another film I loved this last year, which was A Hidden Life. I don't know if you saw that, but, and Terrence Malick talked to his composer about, yeah, the suffering inherent in love, and how something so beautiful that you want to hold on to, even as you know it's beautiful, you're sad about losing it. Yeah. And I feel like that's all throughout this movie, because Joe's like mourning the loss of childhood. So it's this bittersweet, truly bittersweet marriage of sad and love. And you're sad because of the love.
Obviously, like all filmmakers, I love Terrence Malick. And I do think Terrence Malick is maybe one of the best who's ever captured that sense of those moments that go, but that, We don't know when you die what you see, but I might look something like a Terrence Malick movie, like the little moments of life. And I think too, you know, that idea of not of art being the way you save it. Like, you can't save your sister, but you can write it down. That's the best you can do. Or you can make a movie, or you can make a song. And I think that that's always been something I'm interested in. And I'm very honored to be in the same sentence as Terrence Malick.